We have a special guest on the podcast today. I am here with Bradley Clark, CFP, RICP, who is one of our recommended financial advisors that you will find on the White Coat Investor recommended financial page. Welcome to the White Coat Investor podcast, Bradley.
Thanks so much for having me. I've been a fan for years. I think that there was a discussion years ago about, I think you may have declared that bonds now belong in taxable. And I loved that, this notion that interest rates fell so much that maybe we need to revisit asset location preferences. And the fact that you are getting into that level of insight in what you're doing, not only for physicians, but for all sorts of non-physicians that have found you guys, I've always been a fan and glad to support you and finally meet you.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you here and be partnering with you. Tell us a little bit about you. What made you decide you wanted to be a financial advisor?
It's a great question. It all goes back to the spring of 96. I was at Stanford Business School and I was taking modern portfolio theory from Bill Sharpe himself. One of my favorite Sharpe articles is called The Arithmetic of Passive Investing. And he pitched us on this in class. And my jaw dropped at this premise that our society is shoveling hundreds of billions of dollars towards something that actually does not create value, which is stock picking and active management. So I guess it was in that moment that my life was to be transformed, but it ended up taking me 15 or 18 years of business and entrepreneurial and marketing jobs and publishing jobs to then come full circle to actually, you know, put out my shingle and start my firm.
And the firm you started is Clark Asset Management. And what would you say is particularly unique about Clark Asset Management and what you do well?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have managed to end up in a small, valuable, and I think defensible niche. We hold ourselves out as one of the only truly fixed flat fee retirement income experts in the country. So most retirement income experts are slinging annuities with high commissions for the expert. And then most wealth management shops are charging AUM. There's a few that have flat fees, but when you dig in, they tend to be more complex, net worth driven or tiered or something else. And so we're out there with one price, wealth management, financial planning. And a few years ago, we kind of bet the firm on retirement income planning. So our sweet spot is people who will be retiring in the next, let's say, 5 years, or maybe they recently retired or anything in between, typically 2 to 8 million liquid. And we have really become experts in the types of stuff you would expect, right? So Social Security claiming, long-term care planning, Medicare planning. We do bond ladders. We do commission-free annuities. So we see the same 12 or 14 plays all the time. So we've gotten very good at running those plays.
So tell us about the price and how you decided that was what it was going to be.
So the price is $9,500. That's for financial planning and investment management ongoing, no other forms of compensation, full stop. We launched at $7,500 in 2016. And despite a career in business, I was a little naive about what it was going to take to stand up and operate a high-touch wealth management firm. So at $7,500, there wasn't enough margin for me to hire or reinvest. At $9,500, it's still not a high margin business, but there's enough room there to reinvest in technology and reinvest in people. So I raised the price only once. I really don't want to again. If inflation stays, you know, 5, 6, 8, 9 points or something, obviously I'll have to eventually. But what we're trying to do is just charge a fair and transparent price that's consistent. As it's, I don't know, you probably have heard this term because you're a physician, but you know, I really have a lot of respect for the helping professions. And this is teachers and physicians, nurses, counselors, what have you. And I look at where I work and I don't even work in a profession. I work in an industry. And one of the reasons we price the way we did is to try to do our part of our part to help transform this shady industry into an actual profession, ideally a helping profession. And I think that has to start with the comp model.
Sounds like you've been reading some Jack Bogle lately, too. He very much saw, you know, that people managing money should, you know, basically have this fiduciary, true fiduciary interest in people rather than looking at them as whales to be harpooned, as unfortunately many in the financial services industry do. So I appreciate you sharing that. Well, let's get into some questions from readers and or listeners, rather. And our first one comes from Tom. Let's take a listen to this.
Hi, Dr. Dahl. This is Tom from California. I have a question regarding long-term care. I've recently decided to go ahead and self-insure long-term care risk. My question is, would it make sense to set aside a portion of my investment portfolio specifically for long-term care? And if so, where to locate that, in a tax-deferred or tax-free versus taxable account? And say I'm age 60, if I do not anticipate using it for a certain period of time, hopefully 20 or 30 years, would it make sense to invest those assets in a more aggressive fashion than I am doing for the rest of my retirement portfolio, for instance, at 80 or 90% equities, just for that specific part? That's the first question. And the second is, how much should one typically set aside if they are going to do a segmentation for per person for long-term care? I've heard anything from 3 to 5 years worth of expected expenses. Does that make sense, or would you recommend a different approach? Thanks much.
All right. I think that's a great question. Let's tackle the overarching question here. He's decided he's going to self-insure, which is probably the decision made, I think, by most of your clientele. If most of them are $2 to $8 million portfolios, I'll bet most of them choose not to buy long-term care insurance. But what do you think? Should it be segmented out, or should it just be included in the general nest egg?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I will not get into how to determine whether to self-insure, because that's outside of the scope of his question. But I think the method that you follow for that is critically important. What he's describing, if I translate what he's asking into our kind of geeky language, is what he's talking about is creating an explicit buffer asset. So instead of saying, okay, well, he's got the home, he's got all this money, and the Monte Carlo says he's going to be fine, he wants to take the next step, which is to ring fence off or cordon off a buffer asset. And I haven't seen this a lot, but we have seen it. I do have several clients who have done this. It's really a mental accounting exercise that he's doing. And for years, I was railing against mental accounting because often you can suboptimize the whole if you lean too heavily into mental accounting. But then I gave up on that and I realized that we all are guilty of mental accounting, and it's just part of the human conditions. So I don't resist mental accounting anymore. So what he's trying to do, I think, is fine. On the size, he mentioned 3 to 5 years. I would probably back off of that to 2 to 3 years per spouse, right? So 2 times 2 is 4, 3 times 2 is 6. So something in that 4 to 6 year range total, right, for spending. A nuance here is that sometimes there's scare tactics here around how much it's really going to cost. Remember, if somebody ends up in long-term care, they're probably not traveling to Tuscany and doing some of the things that would have been in the spending plan anyway. So the net impact on spending is significant, but not as significant as you may think, because some of those other spending goals go away. And it's important to do the arithmetic when you think through that. On the asset allocation side, I agree with him, which is it's a longer time horizon, so crank up the equity exposure. But there's another reason, which is there's a very good chance this won't even be used, and therefore could flow to an heir, a beneficiary, a charity. And when you start investing for someone else's time horizon, who's younger than you, it just strengthens or extends his own hypothesis. So instead of 20 to 30 years, there's a very decent chance that money is being invested for 40 or 50 years. right? And so that's another reason, I think, to crank up, you know, the equity exposure. The last thing he asked was about asset location. Where should this be done? And I don't think we can generalize that point. I think that has to be client specific. So I've got a client with millions in taxable accounts. We just cordoned off their biggest gainers and stuck it in a flex brokerage account. Flex mean it's a normal brokerage account, but flex in so much as that money is earmarked either for long-term care and or for their son, right? So it's really, it's going to be one or the other or both. And by cordoning off the highest gainers, as long as the step up in basis at death is preserved, right, then we kind of liked doing this on the taxable side, right? But if there's not a lot of taxable dollars there, right, then you know, a pre-tax environment is fine for something like this.
Yeah, I think your most important point you made is there's a very good chance this money isn't going to be used. And I think you've really got to think about that as you do this. I would argue that that's one of the reasons why you may want to not want to do this mental accounting at all.
Yeah.
There's a very good chance you may not use it at all, but there's a very good chance you're not going to use the whole thing. You know, if you look at the average person home stay, they're nowhere near that 5-year mark, you know?
Right. So if we built a plan without this, let's say we ran all the Monte Carlos and we agreed with the client they can spend 40 grand a year on travel and retirement, and they're happy with that. And then the husband or the wife, they say, hey, well, what about cordoning off a buffer asset? Okay, we can do it and they can afford it. But then to achieve the same Monte Carlo, if all of a sudden those dollars are removed, then instead of 40 grand a year on travel, maybe it's 20, right? So there's an opportunity cost here, which says, they could be restricting, right, their discretionary spend for 30 years unnecessarily. Now, I'm sure it makes them feel good. Mental accounting makes you feel good, but I think you need to understand the opportunity cost.
Yeah, a trip to Tuscany makes you feel good too.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's take our next question on retirement plans. And this one's, I believe, a bit of a convoluted question, but this comes from Matt. Let's take a listen to it and see what we can do in a short period of time to help Matt.
Hi, Dr. Dolly. This is Matt from the Pacific Northwest. My question is about retirement plans. I'm a W-2 employee, but also have 1099 income. At my primary job, my employer contributes to a 401A, and there is no ability for an employee contribution. We do, however, have a 403B and a governmental 457, which I max out. For my 1099 income, I've also been putting away 20% in a solo 401K as an employer contribution. My question is, do I have an ability to make an employee contribution somewhere in this scenario? Let's say I make approximately $50,000 of 1099 income. Can I put 20% of this, so $10,000, into the solo 401k as an employer contribution, plus an additional $20,500 as an employee contribution in 2022? This would essentially mean a total contribution of $30,500. And decrease my taxable 1099 income from $50,000 down to $19,500. Is this plan legitimate? Do you see any better way to optimize my retirement accounts? I also have a backdoor Roth IRA and an HSA. Thank you again so much for everything.
Brad, you want to take a shot at this one to start with?
Sure. So I did listen ahead, and so I have kind of jotted down some notes. I'd like to use, because he was using 2022 limits, because that was the currency that he was using. So for somebody with this many moving parts, I think that the number to start with is the total that can go into these types of plans on the employee and employer side in total. And the total number in 2022 was 61,000. Okay, so let's start with that. That's employee contributions and employer from all types of plans added up together, with one interesting exception, which is the 457. The 457 sits on its own island. Okay, and so there's another $20,500 from 2022 that is available in the 457. But let's just put that to the side for a moment before we add it back in. So within the 67, this gentleman can do $20,500 as an employee and then the balance, $40,500, from the employer. So that's pretty simple. So he mentions lots of different employer things like the 401A. There may or may not be a match in the 403B. He, as a solo 401k owner, gets to do an employer contribution. So you can add up all these employer contributions. The totality of the employer contribution across all non-457 sources is the $20,500. So as long as you honor the $20,500 and honor the 61, you should be fine, right? Now, where the 457 comes in is, since it's on its own island, you get to do that as well. So my understanding is he could do up to 61 plus another $20,500 of the 457 money, right? And then so that's the summary. And what he's saying is right, which is the most he can do on the employer side of the 401k, solo 401k, is approximately 20% of the self 1099 gross income. So he was saying 50, 20% of that is 10, and that's one of the employer sources. Matches count. All these employer sources count as against the 61.
Yeah. I mean, there's basically two rules to keep in mind here. The one is you're limited to $20,500 or $22,500 for 2023 for employee contributions. No matter how many employers you have, no matter how many 401ks you have, you get that employee contribution and that's it if you're under 50. Obviously, you get a catch up if you're 50 plus. But for the total that can go into the plan, that amount, that 61,000 amount in 2022 and 66,000 amount in 2023 is not for everybody. It's per employer. So at the academic job, you got a 401A and a 403B, and you're going to be able to put, you know, $20,500 in that 403B as your employee contribution. Maybe there's a match, maybe there's not. Some amount's going to go into the 401A. That amount total between those two is going to be less than 61,000. And because you used your employee contribution up at your day job at the academic place, you're not going to be able to use it again in the solo 401k. And because you only used, you know, because you only made 50,000, you're only going to be able to put about 10,000 in there as a tax deferred contribution. And the only workaround I know of for that is to make after-tax contributions. If you set up your solo 401k such that it is allowed to take after-tax contributions, you could contribute most of the rest of the $40,000 as an after-tax contribution and potentially do a mega backdoor Roth IRA contribution on that. So that if your goal is really to get as much as you possibly can into retirement plans, that is an option. But I would say what most people do is they max out, you know, whatever's available at the you know, university hospital, and they put their $10,000 as tax deferred money into the solo 401k, and they spend the rest on a home renovation, you know, or use it for their backdoor Roth, that sort of a thing.
Right. Or into HSAs and 529s. And what's interesting here is, to me, this is an order of operations problem. So if you have $100,000 that you can put aside every year, let's say, and it's in a pitcher full of water, represents the $100,000. And you line up all the potential cups, like how much do you pour in each cup in what order as to fully optimize where what we sometimes call the savings waterfall, where those putting those $100,000 to their highest and best use by being smart about how much to fill up each of those cups. And I do want to repeat, everything you said is right. I mean, you did a good job simplifying it. But the 457 is an asterisk on everything that you said. It exists on its own island, right? So there's double dipping that you can do with the 457.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree with that. Totally separate limit for 457s. Likewise, totally separate limit for your IRAs, right? Just because you use the Roth 403B account doesn't mean you can't also get money into a Roth IRA, whether you can contribute directly or whether you can do it through the back door. And what a lot of people run into is, you know, when you have all these accounts available to you, you may not be saving enough to max them all out. So you have to choose the best ones to contribute to. whereas other people are saving so much money that they not only go through all of the accounts, fill them all, but also end up investing a bunch of money into taxable accounts each year. It's just a ratio of how much retirement space you have available to what you're actually saving. And that's going to be different for everybody.
That's right. But even some of those dollars flying into taxable environments, maybe they should be flying into super funding a 529 plan, right? So instead of being trapped in the $500 or $1,000 of savings per month, you know, keep shoving all those taxable dollars into the 529 environments to super fund and top those things off for kids, grandkids, or what have you. And only once you've done that, then start save in a taxable environment.
Yeah, especially with the new option out with Secure 2.0, where there's going to be the potential to roll over leftover 529 money up to $35,000 into Roth IRAs for the beneficiary. So that's a potential additional use for overfunded 529s. All right, let's get to our last question here. This one is about taxable accounts, speak of the devil. This one's from Stephen. Let's take a listen to it.
Hey, Jim, it's Stephen from the Southeast. I have a question about taxable accounts. I had to liquidate mine this past year, but I'm about to restart it. And I plan to use index funds and, you know, try to simplify it as much as possible. But do you think we should, for dividends, or have those automatically reinvested, or should I reinvest those myself? You know, for the sake of tax loss harvesting, I just wanted to try to simplify this as much as possible. So any recommendations about how to kind of go about setting up a simplified brokerage taxable account would be greatly appreciated for tax purposes and just for ease of the whole portfolio. Thanks so much. Hope you have a great day and a good holiday season.
All right. Great question, Stephen. Reinvest dividends in taxable or not, Brad? What's your opinion? What's your recommendation?
So in our firm, we actually like to pay dividends to cash and then rebalance the cash back into the portfolios. And the rationale is pretty simple. It makes it easier to keep portfolios balanced within tolerance bands if you can choose what to buy into. With everything reinvested, you can't use the dividend season or the dividend payouts as an opportunity to keep the portfolio balanced. So that's our preference. Now, what the gentleman said, though, is he referred to simple several times, okay? And in life, everything's a trade-off, and there's so many trade-offs in what he's asking, and I won't take too much time on this. But one dimension he's asking about is tax loss harvesting. Well, if that really is valuable to you, you don't want to own one or two ETFs. You want to own 8 or 10 or 15 ETFs, whatever. There's some level of granularity where there's more opportunity to do tax loss harvesting. But if he really wanted simple, he could have one target date fund or two ETFs, but there'd be less tax loss harvesting opportunity, hence a trade-off. Dividend reinvestment, not reinvestment. Another trade-off of simplicity versus, you know, keeping a portfolio balance. Because who's going to go in there if he's doing this himself? Is he going to go in and do the analysis and rebuy in proportion once a month or twice a month? Or is he simply going to check the box on dividend reinvestment and rebalance annually? There's another part of this that he talks about, whether he mentioned or not, that I was thinking of, which is householding. Like, does he manage this all in equities because it's taxable? Does he want to practice asset location? The question was about taxable, but if he wants to practice asset location, he's got to decide what to put in the taxable account, knowing the balance and components of the pre-tax account. Not simple, but he can squeeze extra blood from the stone. So the fact that he kept saying simple over and over and over again says to me he's willing to make some of these trade-offs that give him less granularity, maybe less rebalancing juice, less householding, all under the mantra of simplicity. There's a quote that I like, and it's attributed to Einstein. I'm not sure if he really said it, which is, you know, you should make things as simple as possible, but no simpler. And where you set that dial is going to be different for different types of investors.
Yeah, very well said. Personally, I'm not a big fan of reinvesting dividends in taxable. I reinvest them in all my other accounts, in my 401ks and Roth IRAs and HSAs. It's all reinvested for simplicity's sake. But in the taxable account, I don't, for the same reason you mentioned. You know, you can rebalance with that money. I reinvest it manually once a month with all my earned income from that month that's going into investments. And the other benefit, of course, is you don't end up with all these little tiny tax lots that you start worrying about wash sales about when you're tax loss harvesting. So I think in general, it's pretty good practice not to reinvest dividends in a taxable account. But you're absolutely right about the trade-off about simplicity. You know, like I tell a lot of people, you know, automating all your investments does not play well with tax loss harvesting. You kind of have to choose one or the other. And it just comes down to what's your time worth? Are you an optimizer or a satisficer? And you've got to make those sorts of decisions.
Agreed.
All right. Well, for those who are interested in learning more about Mr. Clark, BradleyClark.com is where you can learn about Clark Asset Management. He'd be more than willing to sit down and talk with you about whether his firm may be right for you. As he mentioned, it is a flat $9,500. So for those of you with a decent sized portfolio, that is a heck of a deal. You know, if you've been out there paying 1% AUM on a $5 million portfolio, you're about to cut your investment costs or your advisory costs by 80%, which is a heck of a deal. But you've got a couple other things you wanted to mention to people that they could learn more about you with and learn more about investing at the same time. You want to tell us about the videos as well as the book you've got coming out?
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much. So a lot of folks that schedule a call with me will watch a short video class first. It's only an hour of content, 12 5-minute videos. I do a pretty good job in there of keeping things approachable and educational. It doesn't take much time to get through. And almost everybody who books with me mentions the videos. So they're totally free. You can consume them on the website, no problem. I also have a book coming out in Q1 of this year, 2023. The book name is Be the Bird, which I admit is not very explicit about what it's about. But it's a book about retirement income planning, but also confidence and psychology. And there's some stories from my life and lessons learned. And so I'm proud of the book. It's coming out this quarter. It will be available on Amazon. We also have an offer. And I can give the URL. The offer is, if you think you may be a fit with us, and if you are interested in speaking with me, when you book a free consult, we will send you a hard copy of the book, free, no credit card, no shipping costs, none of that nonsense. And to go to that page, it's just BradleyClark/podcast offer. And then you would just, you know, book a call if you think that you're interested and enter in your name and address, and we'll ship that to you. And that's it. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to mention both of those, Jim.
You're welcome. And we'll have links to all of that in the show notes, both the Clark Asset Management as well as to the book if people just want to buy it on Amazon, and to the introductory videos. So thank you so much for partnering with the White Coat Investor. And thank you so much for helping us to answer listener questions today.
Of course, it was fun. Thank you.